Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, everyone. Today we're joined by Mark Pybus. Mark Pybus is Data Practice Director at Contino.io. First of all, welcome to the show, Mark. I'm really looking forward to this conversation a lot.
Thank you, Ben. It's great to be here, and me too.
Yeah, and look, we've got a really interesting conversation ahead of us, right? So we're going to be talking about the evolution of a data professional. Before we get into that huge conversation, in a nutshell, can you just give us a bit of insight into what Contino provides and what your role entails there?
Of course, Ben, thank you. So if I talk about Contino, and I'm proudly wearing the branded T-shirt, of course. Contino is a cloud-native digital transformation agency. Consultancy is actually, I think, a better word there. So we consult with large clients, very often of the blue chip nature, on how to solve their digital development problems. We generally work on cloud platforms, and we build capabilities for our clients. So one of the trends that we see is companies that have a target, they want to become data-driven, or they need to be able to reinvigorate their products. They want to be digital first. They have to compete with digital and cloud native upstarts in their area. Mm-hmm. And they haven't got the tools and experience to be able to do that. So if you're running a business and you want to take your first steps into cloud, that's actually quite difficult to do. If you're already in cloud, it's not working for you. Or you have teams that are moving too slowly, or their error rates are up, or their cycle times are low, so they can't release frequently. Or they just haven't worked out the capabilities that they need and the skills that they need, because generally speaking, this is a people business as much as it is a technology business. So Contino can come in and build out a digital product set. We can go in and we can build that cloud native environment, that cloud native product. Where we work really well is actually building the capability for our clients. So it isn't about give us a work and we will do it and hand it back. It's about we'll come in and we will sit next to you, perhaps not for the last 18 months, of course, actually sitting next to people, but very much that model of pairing and dual delivery and upskilling is very much what Contino does. So another way of putting that is that if you want a digital fish, don't ask Contino for it. If you want to know how to catch a digital fish, come and talk to Contino about it. Because when we have finished our engagements, the client should be able to fish for themselves. So very often it is in the more complex environments, the highly regulated areas, the larger companies, where Contino can have the most impact. And we do that across five different pillars. So we work across all three of the main clouds in the security space, the software development space, the overall digital transformation space, and in the data space, which brings me on to my role. So I head up Contino's data practice in the UK. And that is, that has two sides to it. One is I am still focused on delivery. I take part in delivery. I lead teams in delivery. But actually it's also about the data practice community. And that comes back to the people side of things. It's we're not a bunch of talented individuals. We're a bunch of talented individuals that can work together and can share together as well. So, as an example of that, today happens to be the day that I run the Contino Data Practice Forum, we had six or seven people speaking from within Contino on different subjects. So one was actually something to do with AWS. There was a GCP one, Azure one, one which tended more towards software engineering with data, and one on data quality. That's quite a range, but that showed that the talent that we had available to us. And on the back of that, I know that now the networking side of that has kicked off. And someone's going, "Oh, I didn't know that you were doing that on that gig. Can I ask for some of your time? Can you help me here as well?" And that's really how a consultancy can really make use of the people it has. And as far as the data practice goes, the better that we are internally, the better service we can deliver to our clients as well.
Right. Amazing. I really want to find out about your history and your journey and your background. And so you started out in software. Is that correct, first of all?
It is correct. So I took what somebody of my age, and I think it still is generally the case, a fairly typical path for the time. So at school, I was interested in computers. It was back in the early days of computers starting to become available. Certainly, we had the BBC Micros at school, and then we obviously moved on a little bit from that. And also just the time when you're starting to get computers at home that you potentially program yourself from the ZX Spectrum onwards. So I got interested in computers there, wanted to work out how to make a career there, went to university, I did data science there, and then came out looking for a role. So my first role was as a junior software developer, working for a firm that provided services to newspapers and other firms in that space. And it was very much a development role. I was developing in languages like C, scripting languages like Perl, and then this is actually in the early days of Java as well, not to date myself too much. So to put it in context, I was there for the Y2K bug.
Right, okay. Yeah.
In memory for a lot of people, but oh, everything's going to stop because of the Y2K bug.
Yeah, yeah.
For those of you that are under the age of, I don't know, 30 or 40 and wondering, what am I talking about?
Yeah.
Serious concerns in the late 1990s that the way we had programmed a lot of software was to store the year in two digits. And when it got to 99, it would go back to zero and planes would fall out of the sky.
Right. I do remember this, but is it? But yeah. So, hang on. So it was so when you built things, it was on a digital clock, and then it couldn't get to the thousand mark. Is that right? I don't understand. I don't understand. Yeah. Go on.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. It's like, you know, especially in the early days of computing, storage was very expensive. So you use the least amount of storage that you could. So if you wanted to know the date, you wouldn't write 1976 when the days were only going to go forward. That might make sense if you're trying to represent 1876, but when you're talking about today and tomorrow, you're writing 76. And this was widespread as well. Most of the major libraries store dates in that way. So just to date myself, actually, Samar, one of the systems I was working at then was CFAX. And that had a routine to tell you what was on TV tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it did that by taking the current date and adding one, which is fine if the current date's not the last day of the year in 1999, because add one and 99 goes to 00. Who knows? It was a relatively big thing. There was a lot of money spent on updating systems and hardware as well. And depending on your point of view, it was a waste of money and a damp squib. Or the way I like to look at it is that the sheer amount of effort that went into checking that everything worked meant that there wasn't any major disasters.
Right, okay.
Went on. So it's like insurance. When you pay for it, you know, it feels like a waste of money unless you need to use it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So did nothing really happen then in Y2K? Was it just fine?
No, I think there was some systems and some firms that took some downtime, and there was, I think, things that stopped working, but there wasn't anything major, I remember.
Yeah, crazy times, though, when you think about it. Those times, like late 90s, early 2000s, when you look back, isn't it mad, you know? Computers were just like in their really early days.
It is. My first work computer had a hard disk measured in megabytes. And not that I collect things, but this is the internals of that very hard disk, my first computer all those years ago. Yes, which has been on my desk pretty much constantly since as a coffee.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, for those of you listening, I held up a hard disk platter out of a 5 1/4-inch drive.
Yeah, yeah. Let's paint some colour.
5 1/4-inch drive. Let's just not go there. 5 1/4-inch hard drive, by the way. So anyway, to get back, this was around the time that Java started to become a bit more mainstream. Adopted Java, adopted a database, and I moved on from being a junior software engineer to a team lead. And that was fairly traditional progression over 6 or so years. And that was absolutely back-end software development. I then spent, I think, around about a year doing more business development and project management. And then my career took a twist, but still stuck with the software engineering because I moved into leading teams in web development.
Right.
And app development. So this was around the time that App had released their first iPhone or two. They had come up with the concept of an app store. And they were paying developers to build apps for it. That sounds really weird, but yes, they did. And also where really the sort of like concept of having an application that would run in the browser as well started to actually come. So the whole rich browser experience that you now get out of a browser. So ability to have a web page that you could interact with. Obviously now we're all used to having your email client is generally in a browser.
Yeah.
You can edit Word docs in browser and you've got G Suite and all that. But that wasn't possible in the early days of web, obviously. I saw that change in there and was building that type of M-App. Although along the way, I never really moved away from using data and building systems that incorporated data. But it was much more focused on the end use of data, displaying data, content management of data. As my career then moved forward, they started to become more of the products I was building more in the data analytics space, especially when I started to become responsible for large-scale business units and websites and things like Google Analytics and A-B testing, starting to look at the metrics around data. But also working for a firm that actually sold its data as well, having data as a product then. Okay, and so we don't just want to give the data away, we want to allow people to actually query that data and that type of product. But at this point, I'm up to probably getting definitely over 15 towards 20 years of my career. And the concept of data as an absolute career starts to sort of like come around, because at that point, having a career in databases was a data administrator.
Yeah.
It's more on the software side, a data engineer, a database engineer or a database developer. Your data teams were either using tools off the shelf or writing SQL queries against databases. But then we started to see the rise of big data and data teams following the trend that probably started somewhere in the dot-com boom and the large-scale big tech enterprises making better use of their data. And that enabled me to move into leading data teams. So some of the people that I work with and no doubt are listening to this presume that I've been in data for 20 years. And it's not just because I look like I have. And in some ways I have, but data as we would recognize it now, and especially the field of data analytics, big data, and really making use of data on an industrial scale. That's really only been around in for the last decade or so. And I know that people will point to Hadoop being probably getting over 15 years old now. And I think that that's fair, but in terms of widespread, in terms of widespread use of data, and it, you know, it's now, if your company's not making use of its data, it should be.
Yeah, definitely. And I was wondering as you were talking about the development of the cloud, because, and also I was just wondering, do you think that a lot of businesses or a lot of companies would have either failed or not had the capacity or money to be able to be basically successful without the cloud? How important is the cloud, is what I'm trying to get at.
I think it's important for the pace of innovation and the barriers to entry. I remember when a firm that I was working for started moving to cloud. But actually, a few years previously, we'd already moved away from running our own servers, because there was firms out there that would run the service for you. So we had progressed from having our servers as a service. So fundamentally, we weren't buying our servers, we weren't racking our servers, having to worry about the internet connection for those servers. Somebody else has already, we already had that as a service. But it was still pretty inflexible. It was slow to change and the costs were still pretty fixed. So yes, you could chop and change. But fundamentally, you signed a contract for 1, 2, or 3 years, and that's how much your service cost and how much you had to pay for them. Of course, cloud started to change that. You already had shared hosting though. You could already go and rent part of somebody's server.
Right.
So I think if you look at it from the ability of to access servers and compute resources, it was an improvement and certainly disrupted the market. And in terms of your capital outlay or your commitment and the ability to scale rapidly, it was a game changer. I think the biggest things that cloud's done from a innovation point of view and enabling companies to innovate is the higher level services. So when I first started working with hardware, we used to talk about our disk arrays. You had to know what your disk array was and make sure it had disks in it, and they all worked. And even when we moved forward into private clouds, you were still buying physical big arrays of disks, and then just your private cloud was just presenting that as smaller drives to the individual servers or the services that needed them. Now, we don't think about that at all. We just store something in whatever cloud object storage we are using, so AWS, S3, etc. And that will just carry on scaling for us with pretty much as good a performance as you need from that type of storage. So I think it's that type of service when all of a sudden you're not having to worry about this space at all, it's just there, started to make a change. But then when you start to move forward into the higher order services, so we're going to talk at some point, it's called about machine learning, because it's the cool side of data. One of those talks I've just had today was on the new auto ML service from GCP to automate your machine learning process, and AWS, Azure have one, etc. So the complexities of building from scratch your data science environment, if you didn't have cloud, is really high. And there are some clients that for regulatory reasons, you do end up having to do that. And it's actually quite hard work. But now, you know, if you want to run a model in the cloud or train a model in the cloud. So a service there, you can to the point now where you can just do it point and click. Here's my data. That's the type of model. How does it work? And that is making it so much easier now. I think it's still got a way to go before these start to feel like non-technical products. You're still just to be able to use a cloud, you need quite a large amount of technical capability. But those barriers are lower than I think they have. I would say lower than they've ever been in the past. Apart from that, I think we're now also getting to a point where I'm working on a product at the moment. When I look at the number of cloud services I can use on that project, I think it's 184. And that's just the top-level services in that particular cloud provider. I might struggle to actually tell you what all of those do. So I think just the sheer amount of services, I'm sheer amount of different ways of doing things and making things more complex again. But, it's the same always. I think you do go through a simplification, complexity, and just generally needing lots of experience to make the best use of the tools that you have.
Yeah, definitely. And, as you started out in software and then moved into data, and is there any parallels there? You've gone from software to data. Is there anything that you've seen happen in software that's now happening in data, or does data copy the software trends almost? Do they kind of run almost in parallel? Is there anything that you've noticed?
They're not in parallel. I think that they are lagging. I think when I did my degree, I did a science degree. The context of that course was actually pretty much the same as a software engineering degree for about 80% of it. So you have this engineering degree that was ranked alongside a mechanical engineering degree, but was not bound by the same rules of physics and the same rules of, if you don't get this right, somebody might, a bridge might fall down. And it did not feel much like engineering. It felt like a craft industry where you were building things by hand and seeing if they worked. Now, my beginnings of software engineering is before we had concepts, or at least we were acting on concepts such as testing. Actually, I'm just going to come out and say testing. We weren't automating tests. We didn't have test-driven development. We barely had automated builds back and then. We had patterns and various ways of building things, but really the patterns that then became enshrined in the object-orientated ways of working hadn't seen widespread use. We could code and we could build great systems. It was hard work. We didn't have much. We had tooling there, but certainly it was down to the individual developer largely to do a good job of writing the code. That craft industry and approach to writing software has changed. It may have changed slowly and people might not have noticed, but we have actually become a lot more professional at writing software. And at that, we have been through cycles in that industry that I think I've seen and that have happened in the data industry as well. So we've gone through things like building monoliths and big platforms and systems and deciding that perhaps that's not the way to go. And can we decompose it? I've seen the rise of microservices. I've seen the rise of SOAP and the demise of SOAP, which is, and into RESTful APIs. And now in actual fact, we're probably seeing another change there into API structured more along a GraphQL point of view. And we are getting better at writing large-scale software. We have to be, because we're writing an awful lot more, but that isn't saying it's not hard. We don't get a lot of failures. But also we're getting a lot of automation along today. It used to be that when we got a server, we'd have some notes on how to install that server. And if you're lucky, you had some scripts that you'd use before that would automate some of that for you. But you generally find in a package and you're installing those packages, running some scripts perhaps. Now, well, not only do we have an API to deploy that server in the cloud, we're actually then talking about the images and the containers and things like Docker and Kubernetes. But actually, beyond that, we're actually building those things in automated pipelines as well. So CI/CD, when I entered the industry, did not exist as a term. So continuous integration, continuous development. Jenkins wasn't around. You had Make, which, funny enough, is still around. So you could write some scripts to help you compile your code. That's generally what it was limited to. I remember the team lead that I was working with at the time introduced me to the concept of test-driven development and potentially being able to the automation you can do with back in days tool like Ant. That's now completely mainstream. And if you look at the experience in those 10, 15 years, then for the last decade plus that I've spent in data, I can see some obvious parallels there. So we used to build big software products, big single monolith systems. When big data started to rise, it was the data lake. It was. Let's go and get that. You know, I ran, you know, hundreds and hundreds of CPU nodes. So serious scale data systems on Hadoop. That was one system where you put all of your data. And that was the aim. Nobody really questioned whether that was a good idea or not, to create another monolith. And then, you know, the number of times that's been the bottleneck, that's been the problem, that's been too hard to change. Hadoop is basically dead. I'm going to say it quietly, it's on my CV still, if anybody... it's rather had its day. And from a software point of view, we had the rise of systems thinking, distributed systems, you know, having systems that were not maintained centrally, that had parts of it run within different departments and different teams. And I'm talking very broad sort of like because we did it for back-end systems, we did front-end systems. Facebook is one of those well-known firms that actually went through having, I think they used PHP, I'm going to say, in the early days. Probably still, but they wrote a monolith in PHP that they found it hard to maintain and broke it up and went through a microservices way of working. But I am going back now quite a long time, and Facebook certainly don't do that nowadays. But if we draw the parallels over to data, in the last couple of years, one of the trends that we're seeing is rise of the data mesh, which is a monolith data platform here. Let's leave the data with individual domains, have them work and present their own data for use within a wider systems. You think that's a pattern I've seen before. You know, we've been through that and done that through software monoliths. Now we're doing it with our data monoliths. And actual fact, the early writings on data mesh said exactly that. They said, you know, the actual concept here isn't new. Applying it to data is. And I think to actually look sort of like broader as well at how we program in data and why actually I believe that software engineers make great data engineers is some of the changes that have gone on there as well. You know, we've never been good at version control in SQL. Well, actual fact, when I started programming, it didn't have that much version control either. You know, I remember version, you'd have a copy of your code, but you know, we definitely, you know, until the arrival of tools like CVS, we had nothing like what we call a modern Git-based. We don't have Git for data. We still don't really have that. There's some really promising tools out there now and ways of versioning your data. So you've got this data engineering community that is changing now, but going back a few years, concepts such as test automation for your data, you know, didn't really do that. Versioning, to be fair, some of that is that there are aspects of data which is difficult. So data is immutable, generally is seen as such, which means that you have quite a large body that you generally don't create a new version of. And there's some complexities there for how you go about testing it. But the idea of actual fact, the way that we program our data engineering, going on the same path of programming software did, and in actual fact, our automation tools are getting better. Our ability to define what it is we are doing is getting better. Our ability then to automatically test that. Things like being able to version control changes to our data. When I started out in data, if you didn't take a copy of your data before you started making changes, that was it. You weren't rolling back. Now you have a whole data warehouses out there where, you know, you can just choose a point in time and roll it back. You know, you have big data stores where you can do that as well. So you've got that sort of parallel as well. And I remember being introduced, I'm not going to name too many products from my past here too. There is a concept of this enterprise service bus where all your systems talk via messages. And I remember when that came out as a real pattern that you started to see. It's a pattern that has actually been around for absolutely decades. But in the early 2000s, especially with implementations in Java, you started to be able to use that at the enterprise. Great idea. It was so hard to do. So many of those projects failed. It was a pattern that was hard to do. And I think it went away basically for a few years. If anybody's ever worked in streaming technologies and with tools like Kafka, it's back. The enterprise service bus has had a second coming. We don't call it that anymore as a pattern, but from a software development point of view, the idea of using queues and the pub sum model to communicate between different systems is mainstream. And how we're doing that, it's just too hard work, I think, you know, back in the day, really. And that's now coming to data as well. So break up these monolith data platforms. We need ways to be able to communicate around. In actual fact, what are we looking for? Well, we're looking at queues and we're looking at the pub sub pattern.
I'm
working on a project, or one of the teams that I work with is working on a project at the moment, and it is exposing data via a centralized queuing model. But basically, you just publish onto a queue and somebody else handles it for you. And if you want some data, you request it and it gets put in a queue back for you. That type of pattern in data is especially at a large scale, is not really seen. It's seen, it's not widely used. But it's in software. And again, I just think it's that lagging thing there, in that there are so many parallels to how we used to write and manage our software, to how we're writing and managing our data. You know, things like we're now much better at monitoring our data platforms and our data pipelines. Most of the concepts there came to data after software.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? And I think, you know, that probably gives you quite a good idea of what may be about to happen, you know, in this space in the future, like you were mentioning about automation and things like that. So it's almost like, I think you can probably still rely upon looking at trends in the software industry and then actually seeing it move into data. I think it's probably quite a strong, you've got quite a strong argument there.
I think, you know, you may just start to see it coming the other way as well. Because we're focused from a machine learning point of view, one of the things that is starting to become apparent to me, and this really over the course of the last year, is when you did, so back when you did software development, you had to have software engineers, and that is who is working on your platform, or these are trade related to software anyway. So your software engineers did your software and they released your software, and that was how it worked. That is generally still how it works. The data has actually changed that somewhat, because yes, we have the data platforms and they're the realm of data engineers. Data engineers are analogous to software engineers. And underpinning that, you've got automation engineers, infrastructure engineers, SRE, DevOps, and data ops, depending on the terms that your site wants to use. But you know, it's still heavily, you can see the links there. But there is one thing that is quite different, and that is there's somebody else interacting with your data, on another group of people. And those users are your data analysts, they're your data scientists. And these are people that are still of a technical nature and might not be out and out programmers, you know, often are. And they might interact with the data less with code, more with SQL or with other tools. But actually, they're part of that data engineering ecosystem, and they actually sometimes have to do the same role there. They have to be able to bring data into that platform, need to be able to transform it and make use of it. But they're not engineers.
Yeah.
And just what I think we now learn have as a trend is a rise of tools to enable that type of technical user, but not an out and out software engineer type person, to be able to bring in data and being able to via a low code interface. And now low code can be quite emotive if you've been brought up coding. But a lot of the newer data platforms, you can do an awful lot by point and clicking and making use of libraries which are there, or writing a small amount of code. And some app development has gone that way, and it's still not frowned upon, but sneered at certainly. And seen more as a product, not how the industry works. Whereas I think that now you might be starting to see that from a data point of view, that we now have got more of those tools, and they seem to be getting much more adoption than at the equivalent phase in the software engineering life cycle. So actually, are we actually going to end up that, you know, low code has been a thing that's been around for again, it's one of those things that maybe from a software engineering, app development, product development, that it's low code about there. I think I was still largely, I agree, it's not. But actually, from a data science and a machine learning and a data engineering point of view, it's probably closer.
Right.
We might see a little bit of a switch
around
there. But because it has different pressures on it, that the data industry might get to low-code data engineering before the software engineering gets to low-code software engineering.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, we'll sort of like see. And, you know, saying that, I think there might be a future for low-code in data engineering. You know, we'll probably upset a good few of my colleagues.
Yeah.
But I sometimes remind them that, you know, they might have been out of uni 5 or 10 years. And they've seen a lot of change. You know, that change will just carry on. And they better learn how to move with it.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody needs to build these platforms. You want to continue coding, you still can. But in actual fact, a data engineer might be just as useful having the knowledge of a product as a knowledge of Python.
Yeah.
Not certainly. No. We could be heading that way.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting. And you mentioned, you know, moving with the changes that happen. So how do you personally keep up with those developments? Because they seem to be happening all the time. You know, there's new frameworks, everything is constantly changing. So, I mean, do you read books? Do you listen to podcasts? Where do you learn about it?
I think the only thing that can help you really keep on top is an interest.
Yeah.
I think if you were trying to professionally keep on top because you thought it was part of your role, it would be too hard. You need to have that inquiring mind and the ability to follow a thread and a satellite stream. I think out and out, how I personally, so I also think that how people learn, how they absorb information changes. Actually, one of the things I've been missing in the last 18 months is conferences and the conversations you have at conferences.
Yeah, I've heard that before. It's not the conferences itself, it's the conversations that you have with this, with the people at the conference.
It is. Yeah. It's the feeling. And, you know, I've seen some really good stuff presented that has just, the room's gone. No, I'm going, oh, yeah. And then I've seen some stuff that looks quite boring, but rooms become energised. You can almost take a pulse and go, that is one to watch.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there isn't a conference I've been to where I'm not taking away something really important that is a nugget of information that has helped me forwards. But it is often just for people and the side chats as well. So I've been missing that. What I've actually come to spend more time on is reading articles online. So I'd always read, but I didn't really go out and seek. So actually, I now have a paid for Medium sub, and I found my Medium feed has a lot of interesting stuff in there. But I think it does come back down to that community as well. So I learn off my colleagues. And one thing I didn't mention about my career, actual fact, is that until Contino, they were enterprises. They were not consultancies. So one of the things that's nice about working in a well-known consultancy is that there's generally people clever than you in everything. We've all got our own skills. But in actual fact, we get the opportunity to work with many different tools at many different clients. So I have clever people that I work with, an internal community that shares. And to be honest, if I see something, I read it and I go, is that really a good idea? Have I missed a point? That's bonkers. I can put it on our internal Slack and someone go, oh yeah, we've like used it there. It's actually better than they say. And I will learn from them as well as from reading. But also, especially in my world, I get to work across different clients and help out on different engagements. So that gives me an opportunity there to go, okay. So because you never know the whole stack that you're working with at any particular client. Perhaps rarely you do. So there's always something new on whatever gig you were doing. So there's always the opportunity there to learn on the job. And I think also, if it's trending the industry or whether it's just being lockdown induced and just me, I'm watching more YouTube videos on tech as well.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because I've found a lot of people are finding resources now from completely, completely different places. I mean, in the past, it would probably used to have been, you know, physical books and also learning from people, which I always think is probably, in my opinion, the best way anyway. But also, you know, you say YouTube, but it's brilliant because you get bite-sized snippets of small bits of key information, which you can then take on and then you can go on and read about it, you know, yourself and take on further learnings. And I think YouTube's brilliant. I'm especially for learning, you know.
I think that's. And then I think obviously there's the side projects and there's trying things out. I think at Contino, unfortunately, because we each get a £5,000 a year training budget as well.
Wow, amazing.
We can do the sort of like talk side of training as well. Actually, I'd spend an appreciable amount of that recently on books, actually, as well, because I got rather back into reading. But I'm probably going to read less on the technical side of the books and more on the storytelling books or the management books. Yeah, I still find the technical handbook a bit dry. But with that training budget, I also get 10 days a year to actually just spend on training. That. If there's something specific that I want to find the time to do and learn I can. And actually, I think I find the way of keeping on top is actually sitting exams in the subjects as well.
Right.
And becoming qualified. Because that for me, and again, everybody's slightly different. That gives me a certain rigor to my learning and tied drive to as well. Obviously, that is funded by Container. And in actual fact, there's always parts of cloud ecosystem you're not that interested in or you've not had to use. But if you have to sit a cert in that area, then you will learn that area as part of that. And when somebody brings it up later, at least you know what it is, you know where to go find out that information, or where you see or where you think it wasn't useful, and then you find the use case where it is.
Yeah.
That's happened. So of course, the last few years, I've gained at least two certifications in each of the three major clouds. So GCP, Azure, and AWS, of course. And that has given me that bedrock of learning in each of those. It also helps that I've delivered projects as well. And actually, as part of doing those site certs, I do set aside a decent amount of time. I'm rather than just read, I get on the hood and do as well. There's so much training out there as well. So even if you just want to do self-paced learning, there are labs on top of labs that you can do where you get a guided introduction to a new service. So doing those certs in the major cloud, and actually further site field. So one of my favorite databases is Snowflake Data Warehouses, and I'm a Snowflake Pro certified. No, Snow Pro certified is
right. Okay.
And again, that was great for me because it gave me that focus, that syllabus, that area to go through, make sure that I covered over it. And I wasn't just using a bit that I was comfortable with. And then actually further afield, I've got a FinOps cert as well, because I thought I knew it, but wanted to check.
Yeah.
So that's how I learn. Those, I think, are the most important to me. So there's quite a wide range there, is probably the community and my colleagues and further and what they say, and medium. And it's just, you know, you get plenty of input can pass your desk, and then it's just interested in it and recognizing it and going away and reading.
Yeah. And you did forget to mention, Mark, obviously the number one resource is the Venturi's Voice podcast. But it's so obvious.
Without saying.
I presume it was just so obvious that you didn't feel the need to say it, yeah. Because,
I think one of the reasons not is that I generally listen to podcasts on my laptop.
Right.
And not listening to podcasts when I'm walking around or driving.
Yeah.
I prefer something like not to. So when I'm playing something on my laptop, be that YouTube or a podcast.
Yeah.
In my laptop. And also, it's a laptop. I often have something playing when I'm making tea.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I mean, I like to kind of like, I don't know, do house admin, or like people call it life admin now, whilst listening to a podcast. Or like, I don't know, tidying the house with a podcast on. Just doing some kind of like menial kind of stuff where you can actually just not think about anything but the podcast. I just find it really therapeutic, and I find that information goes in a lot better that way. And yeah, it's an interesting medium, isn't it, the podcast?
It's the best one.
Nicely recovered there, Mark. All right, well, you know, I think we could wrap up shortly, but I'd like to ask you another question. If you could think back to the beginning of your career, when you first started out in, let's say in your career in data, has there been any obstacles that you've had to get over, or, you know, had to get through to get to where you are today as a data practice director?
That's some interesting question, because it's not been smooth. It hasn't been completely smooth, you know, and I'm not saying that there's been bumps there, but it's increasingly, I think, hard for an individual to plan a career anyway now.
It is, yeah.
In it's pointless planning 5 years because everything will change in 5 years.
Yeah.
So is where it is. I think from a professional point of view, switching industry was probably the largest obstacle. So when I left university looking for a job, I didn't think of the industry. I thought of the software engineering side of things, and I think potentially I could have thought about it more. So my first job was in media. I then spent 11 years working for the same firm. I did multiple jobs and roles there. That was 11 years in media. My next job was 6 years in media.
Right.
I then realised, oh, crikey, I'm only going to work in media. And the problem was, especially the traditional print media has been under a lot of threats. It's a declining industry. It's not going to be investment into tech that potentially it could have. So if you want to be more at the cutting edge and do more interesting things, you can't do it in media. And I think the more senior you get, the more you get stuck into the industry as regards to technology. So I think that the obstacle that I had was realizing that if I wanted to move out of media, I had to accept I probably wasn't going to get a role at the same level. I was going to have to drop down a level.
Yeah,
I wasn't going to be a head of department. I was going to be a engineering manager, which was around about in my career where that change came. And it probably took me a little while to realize that and accept it and go, sorry, I only have to do engineering manager for a year to prove that, to learn that new industry. And I don't think that is true if you're going after a solely technical job. I've always been quite interested in the business side of things as well. And the more senior you get, even within a technical team, the more input you have into the business and the more exposure there as well.
Yeah.
And also just the ways of working and the ecosystems of partners and tools and products used do cluster around particular verticals as well. So you might know everything about building software engineering for a media company, but software engineering in an oil and gas company could look quite different.
Yeah.
So certainly that, and I think certainly, you know, at a mental level, there's been a few things there as well. And just to run through a couple on this site, it's like, first of all, which is almost laughable now, but when I started out in my early career, there wasn't anybody around really beyond their 30s.
Right.
So I didn't see any role models.
Yeah.
Much into the past. There wasn't any old people working on software engineers. I'm sure there was, you know, there's obviously still the 70, 80, 90 year old COBOL guys, guys out there. But certainly with the large expansion you got in the late 90s, the older people in the career probably only came from the 80s.
Yeah.
So the older guys were sort of like tending towards 40, and I had this mental picture of, crikey, if I start getting lines and grey hair, which I now have both, actually not too much grey, but certainly the lines, I'm going to be out of this. I need to think about what my other career is going to be, or, you know, potentially I should use moisturiser and dye my hair.
Really? Was that a genuine concern of yours?
It's a genuine concern. I'm thinking, you know, I can't become old in this industry because old people don't have a career here.
Yeah.
It's probably a little bit laughable now because now I sit in teams where, you know, I am sometimes towards the older end, but actually often there are plenty of balding, wrinkly people in their 40s and 50s doing hardcore engineering jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because people that were my age when I was concerned about it are still around and still being able to sort of like do that. And I think the pace of change as well. I think, you know, everybody working in the industry has seen people just drop to the wayside because they just not wanted to sort of change or not been able to sort of change.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, you know, I've got to let you get back on with your day, Mark. I could literally sit here and chat to you literally all day. I mean, it feels like we've just scraped the surface with this. You've got to come back on the show, you know, in a few months, just to, you know, have another conversation, basically. It's been really interesting. So, yeah, thanks for coming on the show. Actually, before we go, let's just point out that one of your colleagues, Ben Simmons, has also been on the show. So take a listen to that if you've enjoyed this. But yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Mark. I've really enjoyed it, and it's been incredibly interesting. Yeah, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.